And welcome back to another episode of the Real Conversations podcast. I'm your host, Jacob O'Connor. Real Conversations is a podcast for those dedicated to doing hard things and living a meaningful life. This belief is perhaps best encapsulated by a quote from the great Teddy Roosevelt. It is not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles, nor where the doer of deeds could have done them better. Now the credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena. With that being said, welcome back to another episode of Real Conversations. And before we get into this episode, just a quick update announcement. I'll be heading on the road for a little bit of a podcast road tour. So I'll be going and sitting down in person to record episodes with a few people that I've previously had on the podcast and then some new people that I haven't had on before. I think that these will be some of the better episodes that I've released to date. There's just something about being in person that makes it a more intimate experience and the conversations have a little bit more depth to them. So I always enjoy whenever I have the opportunity to do that. So as always, if you guys get any sort of value out of these episodes, please share the link with a friend. It really helps us grow. We have seen the numbers slowly increase over time. And actually the Instagram has been doing really well. Had a couple of posts that have really started to resonate with people, I think is the fairest way to put that. So please continue to share the show and to share the links out with friends and people you think could get value from this podcast. This week's episode is going to be another rendition of the RC Rewind segment. This is where I share episodes from the Venture Mentality podcast that I did back while I was in high school. And this week's episode, I think, is one that has an incredible amount of value. It is the episode with the founder of Netflix, Mark Randolph. A couple things to keep in mind while you listen to this episode. The first one being, I didn't have the same equipment, hardware, and software that I currently do now. And so you may notice there's an audio difference. And so just bear with that in mind. We've made quite an investment into our setup now, and that's why things are much smoother and more crisp. There may be a little bit more of a muffle or a lag in this episode, but I don't think it takes away from the meaning. The second thing to keep in mind is I was much younger when I recorded this episode with Mark, much more inexperienced, and I probably would have done things a little bit differently if I were to re-record it now. And who knows, maybe I will have that opportunity again. But hindsight is always 20/20, and I think regardless of these factors, this episode is one that you can extract a lot of value from. It's not every day that you get to hear from the person who founded such a large, massive company that I would venture to say every person listening to this podcast has used their technology, their software, Netflix. It is just an incredible accomplishment. And Mark is very real and authentic in sharing his journey and his story. So without further ado, here is the RC Rewind episode with Mark Randolph, the founder of Netflix.
One of the big things I realized in the 15 years since I left Netflix was that the techniques that I learned starting and running businesses, all those tips and all those little tricks, they are broadly applicable. They're not just applicable to starting businesses, but they work for everything. And everyone has ideas. We all have dreams. We all have things we want to accomplish, and we're not quite sure how to go about them. And I realized these exact same things you would use to start a for-profit venture are the same things you'd use to acquire anything in your life.
Hey guys, welcome back to the Venture Mentality Podcast. I'm your host, Jacob O'Connor. Today joining us is the Silicon Valley entrepreneur and founder and first CEO of Netflix, Mark Randolph. What's up, Mark?
Not too much, Jacob. How are you doing?
I am fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us today.
It's a pleasure.
Of course.
Just sitting around in my house with nothing else to do, so this is perfect.
No better way to spend my time right now, I can tell you that. So I want to start off by talking about the 8 rules for success that your dad gave you when you just graduated from college. I think this is a great place for us to start.
Sure. So, you know, as you mentioned, I start the epilogue of the book with that. My dad, when I was just about to start my first job, so this was just a little bit after college, called me in and handed me a little piece of paper that he'd torn off a pad where he had written in ink what he called the Randolph Rules of Success. And these were all the things that he thought that I should know before starting my first job. And it was really kind of touching in a way because, you know, my dad was a pretty successful business person, but these weren't business rules. This wasn't like, buy high and, you know, buy low and sell high, or happiness is positive cash flow, or some other bullshit. What they really were the rules to being a good person. I mean, basically, like, not representing as fact things that are opinions, or being open-minded but skeptical, being prompt. Basic this rules for how to treat people. And I've always really kept those close to myself, because I kind of realized that fundamentally that is the key to success, not these other external markers. It really is the relationship you have with your co-founders, maintaining relationship with your family during this whole process. That's what success is.
What do you think it is about these rules that kind of like drew you to them? Because I know that a lot of people, they're constantly getting information. People are constantly giving them advice. But for these, they seem to stick to you. What was it?
I think their timeliness, their timelessness, the fact that they were universal, and the fact that they were genuinely him. I mean, reading those, I kind of realized these were all the principles that made him, in my opinion, a decent man. And of course, almost anybody growing up kind of has things they admire about their parents, or about their father in particular, and kind of want to emulate. And here he was, in some ways, saying, these are the ones that if you're going to emulate something to be a successful person, that I think makes sense.
I completely agree with that. And so now I want to talk about how you got into entrepreneurship, because I think my listeners will be surprised to know that you weren't always in entrepreneurship. You actually did a little bit of real estate and different jobs like that. So how did you get into it?
Well, I'm going to contradict you. In some ways, I always was an entrepreneur, in that I've always been a person who saw problems and said, how can I solve those problems? I always saw ideas as things that had to be made real, or at least figured out if they could be made real, rather than somebody who ignored them. And even young, you know, I was always selling things. I was always starting clubs. I was always starting magazines. It just, to me, was this natural thing I wanted to do, which really is what entrepreneurship is. It's seeing problems and going, I wonder if there's a way to solve them. Professionally, I guess didn't start initially as an entrepreneur. You know, I did, I sold real estate. The true term was I worked for a real estate firm for a while, but thank God I didn't sell any real estate. Because if I had sold a house, and this was in a fairly affluent community, and I had made $15,000 or $20,000, I'd probably still be running a real estate firm now. Instead, I totally struck out and then looked for another job. And it turns out that I ended up getting this job, which involved following the CEO of a music publishing company around during the day with a pad. You know, now those jobs have a fancy title. They're called chief of staff. But back then, I was just a guy with a pad. And I'd watch the CEO, and he'd be in a meeting with someone, and he'd tell the person would say to him, I'll have you those numbers by Wednesday. And I'd write down, make sure Joe has the numbers by Wednesday. Or the president would say, I'll make sure this happens. I'm going to make sure. I was a follow through guy. But doing this, I saw every aspect of this music publishing company. And one of the places that was part of this music publishing company was a mail order company. Mail order division, which at the time was simply a two sentence line in the back of every songbook this music publishing company's put out that said, for a list of more great songbooks, send a self-addressed stamped envelope to an address. And for some weird reason, I wanted that job and took that job, and kind of in a way began my first for-profit entrepreneurship situation, where I built up within this other company a big mail order division, which at first was, yes, taking the going out and making a Xerox copy of the list of more great songbooks, putting it in the self-addressed stamped envelope and mailing it back. When the order came in, I'd go and pick the book out of the warehouse and mail it out. And loved it and began experimenting with color, with two-page, with catalogs, with mailings. And again, just this curiosity of how can I make this work better? And then just never stopped. That led to another mail order company. That led to a magazine. That led to turning around a mail order company in California, which got me in the software business. Kind of a never-ending chain of weird entrepreneurial events.
Exactly. You know, and as you said beforehand, you know, I'm glad you did contradict me. I always look at it as entrepreneurship is kind of a lifestyle, you know, like not everyone is necessarily running their own business, but you're all like the CEO of your own life.
Yeah, it's very true. And in fact, one of the big things I realized in the 15 years since I left Netflix was that the techniques that I learned starting and running businesses, all those tips and all those little tricks, they are broadly applicable. They're not just applicable to starting businesses, but they work for everything. And everyone has ideas. We all have dreams. We all have things we want to accomplish, and we're not quite sure how to go about them. And I realized these exact same things you would use to start a for-profit venture are the same things you'd use to acquire anything in your life, to be, so to speak, the CEO of your life, regardless of what that that entails. And it's all the same thing. It's getting started. It's recognizing that you've got to test things. It's having confidence in yourself. I mean, if you want the Randolph Jr.'s Rules of Success, that really is why I wrote That Will Never Work, is I wanted to put down and show in action all those little things that I've learned over 40 years as an entrepreneur.
That's awesome. So, you know, with your 40 years of experience as an entrepreneur, I'm so excited that you wrote the book, That Will Never Work. And I want to go dive deep into it, you know, like what it's about, what your purpose behind it was, what your goal with it is. So just tell us about that book.
So there's really two reasons I wrote it. I mean, the first one is the one we just discussed, which is I did want to find a place to reveal a lot of these tricks for making your dreams real. You know, one of the things I've kind of picked up is that the most common advice that any person gets, especially a young person, is follow your dreams. Follow your dreams. And then, of course, no one ever tells you how. And there's no college which offers a follow your dreams 101 course. And I realize that what I've learned is all these ways you can follow your dreams. And that's one reason I wanted to write the book. But I also wanted to tell the Netflix story. You know, there's this sense in the world that these big successful companies spring forth fully formed from some magical idea. You know, that this idea that everyone is like Newton underneath the apple tree or Archimedes in the bathtub or just aha, eureka. And it's not like that. I mean, these ideas are not one person's ideas. They're many people's ideas. And usually it's a long meandering path of hundreds of bad ideas. And it's a contribution of lots of people. It's lots of hard times. And I wanted people to see, warts and all, what it takes and what goes into starting a company like that. But I guess most fundamentally, I wanted to show the personal journey. I mean, this is a memoir. I wanted to tell the stories of the struggles that I had learning what success means, of learning the power of corporate cultures, of learning how to find balance in your life, of learning how to ensure your family is with you. I mean, all these basic things that I think all of us struggle with.
Yeah, I definitely think that those different things, they apply to all of us in different ways. And so what I would like you to do then is kind of very briefly give the story of the founding of Netflix. You know, obviously I know that you could talk for hours about that, but kind of briefly give that and then really hit on the struggles as you go along with it. Because, you know, I think that you would agree a lot of times that's what's overlooked, but that's what's like the most important part is to learn from it and to hear about it.
Yeah. So the story of Netflix probably best starts when in a company that I had co-founded, which was a small tech company, it had about a dozen people in it. And we had been working for not long, 8 months, 9 months. We were still in beta, hadn't even shipped a product yet. And then that great Silicon Valley thing happened where our software company was acquired. And it's a great thing because everyone all of a sudden makes money, the investors make money, your stock options are worth something, and you get a job ideally at the big company that just bought you. Great thing. And in this case, there was two little bonuses. One was that this company that bought us had been started and was being run by a guy named Reed Hastings. And the other 11 people in the company who were all the technical side went and worked in the basement in a business unit. But Reed had me become the head of marketing for his big company. And I got to know Reed really well that way. And the second big bonus is that it turned out that Reed and I lived in the same town in Santa Cruz, California. And so we began commuting back and forth to work together. And we did that for another 6 to 8 months. And then lightning struck again. And our big software company was now going to be acquired by an even bigger software company. And again, investors made a lot of money. But this time, the outcome was different, and that both Reed and I were going to lose our jobs, that they didn't need us in the next big company. But these are big companies. They're both public companies. This would take about 6 months for the merger to take effect. And so we had 6 months with pretty much nothing to do. And Reed decided he was going to get a higher degree in education and change the world of education as an educational philanthropist. I decided I was going to start another company. 6 months. This is perfect. But we needed the idea. And so and I was going to start the company, Reed decided he would be the angel investor. And so to find the idea, what we did was we began carpooling back and forth to work every day, brainstorming ideas. And hundreds of ideas. I mean, my criteria was exceptionally broad. All I wanted to do was sell something on the internet, ideally with personalization. And so these were weird ideas. Like one of them was shampoo by mail. Yeah, as you can tell, that's a big news for me.
That's awesome.
Like you would cut off a lock of your hair, you'd mail it in, and our team, a crack team of hair scientists, would formulate the ideal shampoo for you, and you'd subscribe to it. Genius.
Why do we not have this?
I don't know. It's a huge lack in the world. It probably exists, actually. But anyway, it didn't work at the time, so bad idea. Then another one was personalized dog food, where we formulate a custom blend formulated for your dog's breed, its gender, its size, its climate, activity level, etc. And that also bad idea. And then one of the ideas was, let's do video rental by mail. And at the time, video rental, you probably aren't old enough to, maybe you do, like the video, there was on VHS cassettes, like not DVDs. They were big and heavy. And so again, same as the dog food and the shampoo, which is out the car window during these commutes. And then the lucky break came, which is that we heard about this new technology called the DVD being test marketed. And it wasn't like in an instant it would have become clear we should try DVD rental because of the DVD. It was more, we had this idea that I'd already researched and had found flawed because of the cost and weight and size of a VHS. And all of a sudden, this little DVD might solve all those problems. And so here's the thing that an entrepreneur does, is that we had the idea, maybe we could do DVD rental by mail, rather than rushing to the office and working on the business plan, or hurrying home and putting together the pitch deck. We said, let's just figure out whether this makes any sense. Let's do a quick test. And of course, you can't buy DVDs. So we went down to Santa Cruz and bought a used music CD, same size and same shape, and mailed it to Reed's house in Santa Cruz, just to see whether you could, in fact, mail a DVD through the mail. And when it showed up at his house in less than 24 hours for the price of a first-class stamp and a little pink gift envelope, we knew that, wow, this actually might work. And in many ways, that was the inciting event for Netflix. Was there was some research after that, figuring out, you know, how many DVD players would be sold, how hard it'd be to build a website. But eventually, based on very little besides confidence, Reed wrote a check for $1.9 million. We raised $100,000 from some other friends and family. I rented this little crappy office in Scotts Valley, California, in an old bank building with smelly old carpeting. And we brought in beach chairs and card tables, and then spent 6 months building a website. And April 14th, 1 week ago, 22 years ago in 1998, we launched that DVD rental by mail company called Netflix.
That is so cool to hear the story. So at this time, were you the first one to have the idea of the online e-commerce DVD kind of website, or is that already something that other people were doing?
No, in fact, e-commerce was brand new, but it was happening. And in fact, Amazon was already out there, and Amazon, in fact, had already gone public, but at the time, it was only a bookstore. So the feeling was, what everyone who was in that category was looking at going, oh my gosh, look at what's happening. He is selling books online. That is amazing, because this is not an obvious thing at all. And so all of a sudden, in a way, there's a gold rush, which is everyone's going, what other categories can we now sell over the internet? And, you know, we skipped over a big part of my career, but the first 15 years from those days in the direct mail division of Cherry Lane Music, I was a direct marketing guy. I was a junk mail king. I did catalogs. I did magazine circulation. So when the internet came along, I immediately saw how fertile this ground was for doing direct marketing on steroids. So it was seen, but we were certainly a pioneer. And certainly the reason we picked this was that nobody was doing it. No one was stupid enough to do DVD rental by mail. I mean, that was ridiculous. But we, for some crazy reason, thought we might have a window to improve upon what we thought was a very bad customer experience that somebody would get through a Blockbuster, say.
That's awesome. So now I want to draw some parallels. You tested the idea. You had the idea. You tested the idea. Then how did you scale? Because this next part, I think, is what's the hardest for everyone.
Wow. I mean, we tested the idea. And then fundamentally, the only real way, you built the website, launched the company, solved a huge amount of problems. Just so you know that launching a company, an e-commerce company in 1998 is not anything close to what it is now. Because now, if you want a website, fine, you just go to Squarespace and boom, go to Shopify. You need a payment portal, you get PayPal. You know, you want A/B testing, Optimizely. It's easy. Then you wanted any of those things. You wanted the payment portals. You had to build them yourself. You wanted redundancy. You wanted the servers. Had to build them yourself.
Oh man.
Everything. There was no cloud. Your backup had to be built yourself. Everything you built yourself. It took 6 months. So we thought we'd solved all these problems. We'd sourced every DVD. We'd built written content. And we launched the company and then immediately realized that all the people who had told me that will never work, which is why I called the book That Will Never Work, were right. It was a terrible idea that nobody was renting from us. So scaling can't happen until you've found a repeatable and scalable business model, which is something that ideally people want and are willing to pay more for than it costs you to provide the service. And it took us a year and a half to find that. So that first year and a half was struggle. It was constantly trying different things. We learned, some amazing things. And perhaps the most important insight was that at first, when we were desperately trying to figure it out, there was no shortage of ideas, no shortage of things to try. The problem was that I was a perfectionist. So I was doing these perfect little tests with, custom photography, and every word of copy was perfect, and the site was stress tested. And it would take us weeks to do these tests and then launch them, and they'd fail. And we'd realize we just wasted weeks. So we'd speed it up and do a test in a week, and it would fail. Then we'd do a test in 2 days. And pretty soon we were just doing three or four different things a day, and they were terrible. They were broken links, and they'd crash the site, and there'd be misspellings and wrong images. And here's the insight, is that it didn't make a difference. That if these were bad ideas, that even these perfectly crafted tests wouldn't make them good ideas. But if they were good ideas, then you immediately knew what to fix. So that was the insight here. And a year and a half later, we stumbled on the thing that ultimately worked, which was totally unintuitive, which was, I don't know, again, if you remember this part of it, but it was the unlimited rentals, no due dates and no late fees, and a subscription. And that service took us a year and a half to find. But once we found it, then we were ready to, as you say, scale, to begin really building the business.
What was it during that year and a half of struggle that kept you going? Because, you know, you have all these people saying that it's not going to work. You're incurring all these different problems. What was it that, you know, you didn't give up?
Well, the first thing is, when someone says that'll never work to me, it's like waving a red flag in front of a bull, which is, I double down on, I'm going to figure this out. But it also speaks to the essence of what it means to be an entrepreneur. And I think a little bit of that is lost these days, because it's now become glorified to be an entrepreneur. And people see it in the popular media. They see television shows about it, or they see movies, and they think it's all about parties and pitching people. They think it's Shark Tank or being rich or being famous. And it's none of those things. The thing which is wonderful and exciting about being an entrepreneur is the fact that you have no idea what's going to happen. That every day is about solving problems. That it's sitting down at the table with these really smart people and doing puzzles. And I love that. Because each time you test something, almost all the time they don't work. But occasionally you get a glimmer of something that, oh, that might work. And you get excited about trying the next thing and trying the next thing. Yeah, and sure, it's discouraging at times when that goes on for months and months, but there's always this feeling of, we're making progress. Any day now, we're going to find the answer. That's what keeps you going. And you have to surround yourself with like-minded people who share that passion for discovery and for solving a problem that hasn't been solved, especially a really hard one.
How do you find that group of like-minded people?
Well, in my case, I was pretty lucky in that I was 38 when I started Netflix, and it was my sixth startup. So as with anything, you begin accumulating people who you found in previous jobs that think that way. And it's, I don't know, have you ever seen the movie, The Blues Brothers?
I've not.
You know, I guess a lot of movies start this way. Or Uncle Buck. You ever see Uncle Buck? So they all start with, we got to get the gang back together again. And the first half of the movie is everyone driving around recruiting all their old teammates to come and do one last game or one last gig, in the case of the Blues Brothers. And it was like that. As soon as I go, oh, wow, we're going to start another company, I immediately began getting the band back together again, which was people like T. Smith and Christina Kish and all these people that I'd worked with. And you have them tap their networks to bring people in. But fundamentally, it's trial and error. You have to find the people who are risk takers. You can't work someone too hard. You've got to tell it like it is. And some people's eyes light up with the excitement of doing the unknown. Other people react with horror and revulsion. And you need to go for the former, not the latter.
Yeah, that'll really tell you which one to take. So that is fantastic advice, Mark. I really appreciate it. So I've got two more questions. The first one being, where can people find you and find the book online?
So the book is That Will Never Work, The Birth of Netflix and the Amazing Life of an Idea. And as they say, available at booksellers everywhere. I certainly encourage people to go to their local bookstore and support them. But it's also available on Amazon, on Barnes & Noble, and anywhere books are sold. And if you do want to find either a list of places to buy the book, or expose yourself to all of my running on at the mouth and at the keyboard. I have a website, which is markrandolph.com. Mark is spelled with a C, Randolph with a PH. You can also find me on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, all the usual haunts.
I will link those in the description so you guys can swipe up and check it out. Mark, I have one last question, but first a little bit of background for you. So when you die, the only thing that matters is the difference that you made and the impact that you had. So that being said, what difference or what impact are you looking to make?
I could answer that a whole bunch of different ways. Fundamentally, I really believe that everybody has ideas in them they want to see become real. And I believe too many people, young, old, and everything in between, have all these reasons why not them. I need to graduate. I need an MBA. I need to be able to write code. I need a co-founder. I need money. I need blah, 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 blah. But the reality is that the trick to taking any idea you have and making it real is entirely within you. And the answer is so simple, which is just starting. So the impact that I hope to have is convincing as many people as I can before I'm gone that if they have this idea that they can make it real, that it does not need to just languish as, oh, I wish I had done this, but that you can do it. And if I can't convince them just with my words, my writing, my speaking, all the events I do now, it's all focused on that one thing, which is help people get off their ass and make their dreams a reality. And professionally, and I can't, you know, depart without mentioning this, you know, I have started now 7 companies, and I'm proud of all of them in their own way. And certainly Netflix is the biggest success, if I could use that word, in that it's now 165 million subscribers, which is astounding to even say those words. And at one level, I kind of was going, it's kind of weird that some people's lifetime achievement is they made a lot of progress in curing disease or in ending world hunger or solving, helping to cure malaria. And my big accomplishment is helping people spend more time in front of a screen. But on the other hand, I'm looking certainly what's happening is now, and I don't know when this will be seen, but right now we're kind of in the midst of a shelter in place order in almost every place in the country. And I know a lot of people are taking a lot of solace from the fact that they have Netflix. And I think that's when you're, you know, if you're out of work and you're worrying about your kids and worrying about your parents, it's nice to sometimes have a little Tiger King that you can escape to.